Well, Nick, it may have taken them a few tries, but the Jays finally got off the schneid here in the second half. Their first win post-All-Star break, a 5-4 victory to, I suppose, salvage the series against the Tigers. But still, the Jays bats, they get Gausman off the hook after the Malloy Grand Salami. Some great individual outings today as well. Varsha with a wild catch that might have saved some heartbreak down the stretch here today at the Rogers Center. And of course, George Springer with two absolute missiles into the seats there. So I think, you know what, I don't think this changes anyone's minds necessarily, but again, I think it's fun to enjoy the victories when they come, and we talked about that in the pregame show, but a lot of great or maybe fun individual performances, even if, ultimately it's not going to change the direction of the season. But Varsho, Gausman gets off the hook, Springer, it was a fun game.
Springer in particular, right? Like both of those early game home runs, they had a lot of difficulty scoring early in games in the last little bit. He gets them going there. He had 10 total bases today. The rest of the team combined for 9. It was one of his better outings as a Blue Jay, to be honest. Yeah. And over the last couple of months, he has been, one of the better hitters in baseball, as crazy as that sounds to say. And it's been efforts like this. It's the power that's come through. Early in the season, it's not like he was striking out all the time. He was taking his walks, but there just didn't seem to be power in that bat. And the thump has returned for George Springer.
That is Nick Ashbourne. I'm Sho Ali. You're listening to Jays Talk live on the Sportsnet Radio Network. We're also streaming on sportsnet.ca and the Sportsnet app. Give us a call, 416-870-0590, 1-888-666-0590, *590 on your cell. You can text us as well, 590-590, name and location. The people's text line always open. Standard messaging and data rates may apply. Yeah, George Springer. I mean, I think the interesting thing with Springer, Nick, is considering we were discussing someone who was providing, like, I would say, generally speaking, a net negative for most of the year in terms of offensive production. Because I don't think his defensive play never really fell off at any point, I would say. Even when he was really struggling offensively, he was throwing the body around out there. He was diving. He was covering tons of ground. He was doing all the things you'd expected from him. So that the right field play had never really fallen off for him. So I'll give him credit for that. But I think that he now, after the terrific couple weeks you were talking about there, that he now is even at league average production, like on the season as a whole, I actually think is pretty impressive considering where he was in the hole to start the whole season. I mean, there was a point near the end of June, mid-June, end of June, where he was dead last in all of Major League Baseball, in both the AL and the NL, when it came to OPS from qualified hitters. So he was sitting at around an OPS of 566 towards mid-end of June. And now, I mean, his OPS is not amazing now, but it's sitting around 700 after the second home run. I mean, that's pretty wild, I would say.
Yeah, he was one of the least productive hitters in the major leagues, and he was hitting sometimes in the lineup, he'd be fifth or sixth or even seventh, and people would say, put him lower or take him out of the lineup entirely. And now he's someone who's carrying this offense. I think it kind of goes to show that we need a little bit of humility when we watch and analyze this game. So many people were saying, smart people who know baseball, that George Springer looked washed up. It looked like he was done. It looked like there was nothing left in the tank. And he's able to come out and surprise everyone over a relatively long span, like a over 20 game type of span. And again, be for a short period of time, albeit one of the better hitters in the entire sport. It just kind of goes to show how quickly things can turn on a dime and how we probably shouldn't be overconfident with our takes, especially early in the season.
You remember when Springer was struggling and he, especially when it became, it almost felt like you couldn't anymore say, oh, he needs to be in the lineup all the time. He needs to be the leadoff hitter. And there's been a couple of different conversations we had about Springer this year. Like, it was when he was leadoff, it's, okay, move him down in the order. He can't be in the leadoff spot anymore. Then it was, he needs to be batting near the bottom of the order. Then it was, he needs to be on the bench, right? Like, those were separate conversations I feel like we had over the span of, 2 months, essentially, to start the season. And I remember when we got to the point where the conversation had taken the turn, Nick, towards, okay, Springer needs to be not playing. He needs to be on the bench more often than he is in the lineup. Remember, so John Schneider would be asked about it on a near daily basis, essentially, whether it was pregame, whether it was postgame. And I feel like I heard him say a bazillion times, like, hey, well, we get access to data that the fans don't or that media doesn't. We get to see all the little things, and we believe it's turning. We believe it's turning. And I think that a lot of people, and this is a conversation you and I have had before, felt that it was like almost they were being too slavish to like certain metrics and so on, which, I mean, you can criticize them, I think, for that absolutely fairly. But I do think it's funny because now that Springer's turned around, honestly, like I'm not speaking for John Schneider. I'm really only speaking for myself. If I was in that position, I would be the smuggest person in the whole wide world. I'm actually impressed that he hasn't said anything to be super smug about it, because you got to think that behind the scenes, a lot of them are like, yeah, like we told you so, right? I mean, and again, they're not right on a lot of things, because those things are super hard to predict. But it's just when it's kind of like when you make a bet and you get a million wrong and you make the one right, and then you feel really good about it and you brag about it on social media. I feel like that's kind of where it is. But I just was thinking about that the other day.
Well, I mean, I don't think there's a lot John Schneider gets to be smug about these days in terms of where this team is in the standing. So maybe you'll take that one. I will say that what Springer is doing right now is beyond the imagine. Like, there was nothing under the surface that indicated something like this was happening. I don't care if you're looking at metrics that the general public can't see. Like, this is beyond the wildest imagination of where the team thought he would go. And so I'm sure they do feel vindicated in the sense that being patient with him was the right move, although partly due to the fact they didn't have great alternatives, to be honest. So being patient with him was definitely the right move overall, but what he's doing now is just beyond anything you could have reasonably predicted.
Let's go to the text line. There's a text here I want to read you, because this is something I was thinking about. And people have like texted about this a couple times, Nick, when it comes to Springer. This is from Jeff in Burlington. 590-590, name and location is the text line, by the way. It's where you can reach us. Jeff in Burlington says, has Springer done enough in the last few weeks to warrant calls from other teams? With that contract, I doubt we get a lot, but maybe would we maybe be able to clear the entire contract? And I think there was another text. Oh, yeah, Mike from the Hammer. Only way I can see Atkins keeping his job if he can trade Springer without eating salary. I think like the eating salary part of any discussion when it comes to Springer is the most interesting part of it, right? Because he's owed a lot of money. Like, it's 25, it's prorated obviously for this year, but two more seasons on the books at $25 million a year. That's a lot. Like, that's a lot of money. I mean, there was another guy on the field today for the Tigers, and Javi Baez, and you kind of wish that, I'm sure the Tigers wish they could eat that or trade that contract without having to eat a lot of the money. But I guess I would be surprised if there were any takers for George Springer. Even what he's doing now is phenomenal, right? Like, I'm not knocking him for it. It's just, it's a lot of money, right? I think there's still a question mark as to what he will be next season when he's a little bit older, and he got off to such a tough start this year. And again, he's not going to do what he's been doing for the last 2 weeks or 20 games or however, whatever, wherever you want to make the cutoff. But he's not going to do this like over the course of probably the rest of the season, because like no hitter, not even Shohei Ohtani's doing what George Springer is doing right now. So he'll probably cool off to a certain extent. I think that's fair to say, but I would be surprised, I guess, Nick, if there was anyone willing to eat that entire contract because of the age and length remaining.
The fact there's two more years makes a big difference here. If he had been this good and this hot, maybe over a slightly longer period of time, and a team thought, oh, we'll take him now while he's hot and we'll ride it out this year, and then next year we'll see what happens and we'll figure it out, I could sort of see that. But he's less than 2 months from turning 35 right now, and to take him for two more seasons beyond this year, that's a tall order. So I think maybe next year, if he's really, you know, continues to be pretty strong and good next year, and the Blue Jays maybe aren't competing, maybe you could trade a year and a half of Springer. He is one of the most accomplished postseason hitters of all time. Like, that's something that teams care about and they consider, even in a world where people like their big sample sizes. But as you say, you know, the age and the contract, it just makes it complicated.
416-870-0590, 1-888-666-0590, star 590 on your cell. Let's go to the phones. Let's go to Eddie in Fort Erie. Eddie, what's up?
How's today?
Hey, Eddie, sorry. Go start over. I didn't hear what you said.
Hey, gentlemen, how's it going?
Oh, hey, no, going well, Eddie. Always fun when we can discuss a win, right?
Absolutely. I have some thoughts about the game and about Springer. I was listening to the text about Springer, and you know what? The Blue Jays, I kind of took away what I was going to say, but I think the Blue Jays have a lot of options in front of them when it comes to Springer. I mean, they could either, you know, keep him for next year, put him in the outfield, like, because, you know, he obviously made some great catches today on that running catch, and then the final out and that leaping catch on the first pitch of the game. Or they could, you know, put him as a DH for next season, or like some of the texters said, you know, what will it take to get him off the books? So they have some options, and it'll be interesting to see what goes on from there. And you know, I just wanted to add on to that, because when I see the Blue Jays obviously looking ahead to 2025, you always wonder who's going to be in their plans. Like when you see Springer play good lately, and obviously another one today was Ernie Clement. I mean, when sure. I see Clement, yeah, and when I see Clement playing lately, it's like he's playing as if it's spring training, where he was basically playing for his life just to get on the team. And I kind of see that, you know, right now with him. And one last thing, show. I know I said a few weeks ago that I thought Varsho should have been an all-star. I know that was a stretch. I'll admit that. But he's got to win a gold glove this year. I mean, that guy has put himself through everything, like crashing into a wall and making great plays. I mean, it's almost like his number had been called or something. And you know what? I hope he does, because if not, he's going to get the Kevin Pillar treatment, where he makes great plays year after year after year and doesn't get a gold glove. So that's what I'm hoping for him after this season's over.
All right, Eddie, thanks for the call, man. Appreciate you joining us on Jays Talk, as always. Okay, so we talked about Springer, Varsho, and Clement. I will say this, Nick. If Varsho doesn't win a gold glove this year, that is, like, downright criminal. Honestly, like, he has been – am I going to pretend that I watch every single outfielder in the rest of baseball? Like, no. But when it comes to the American League, I mean, there's got to be what? Like one or two other guys who are even in the same conversation as him, and like one of those guys probably Kevin Kiermaier, right? So honestly, like, it's not even a slight against the other outfielders in baseball. I do worry, I suppose, to a certain extent, that what will hurt Varsho is that when he plays, he splits a lot, as he did today. He splits time at two different positions, right? So versus a guy who plays every single game in center field, versus Varsho, who plays, you know, like some games in center, some games in left. In games like today, he's plays both positions, essentially. I know that doesn't really matter. I don't think there's an actual number that he has to hit in order to actually be eligible, for example, but when it comes to the Gold Glove Awards. But I just, you see the kinds of things he does today, and he makes them look so routine, I think, is a thing. I think you look at outfield play, and he had a play yesterday, too, where he kind of sped up on a ball that it was hit to him, and I think in left field. And he took a nice route to the ball and snagged it. And he makes plays look like routine flyouts that are anything but. I mean, that ball off of Kelly's bat, 102.7 miles an hour, and an expected batting average of 620, would have been a home run in 12 of 20 ballparks. And would have easily scored a run, maybe even two, based on how things were going. So I was impressed. I got to say, that's just another thing with Varsho. His offense leaves a lot to be desired, but, I mean, you can't say enough positive things about the defense.
There is absolutely no doubt that he deserves a gold glove. He is simply, whether you want to look at the advanced metrics, where you want to, you know, watch him on a consistent day-to-day basis, he is one of the best fielders in the majors at any position. I think he's fascinating to watch, because a lot of times when you see these elite defensive outfielders, it's just they can run like the wind, and they just get to places that other guys can't get to.
Right.
And Varsho can run, but his speed is not elite. What makes him so good is that when he gets in the general vicinity of the ball, like, he just finds a way to complete the catch. And that's a rare skill set. Again, like, normally the guy like Kiermaier runs incredibly fast, and he throws the ball hard, and it's very simple to understand what makes him a good outfielder. Varsho, it's more cerebral, and it's more, I don't know, it's like clutch is a weird way to think about fielding, yeah. But that's kind of what he is. Like, you don't see a lot of balls get by him when he's in the area, and they absolutely need to find a way to get him a gold glove. He's also someone who's going through salary arbitration, and those type of awards make a difference for him,
that's
too.
True. Yeah.
So if he wins a gold glove, that could be a little bit of extra in his bank account this year and next year as he goes through arbitration. So I'm sure it's something that's on him and his agent's mind.
And I know people are like, oh, what about the utility position? So I don't think it's like a formal definition, but I think the utility position, I mean, it's only existed for 2 years, so I suppose they could kind of do whatever they want, but I think it kind of, it's largely given to guys who bounce around at different positions, right? And again, I think that does actually describe Dalton Varsho because he does play a couple different positions. But, I mean, just to look at the two winners of the Utility Award at Gold Glove since it has existed with DJ LeMahieu in 2022, and last year was Mauricio Dubon. And those guys who play like a bazillion positions, essentially, right? So I kind of wonder, you know, I think in Dubon's case, too, he plays the outfield, he plays the infield. DJ LeMahieu, I mean, kind of feels weird to have a conversation about DJ LeMahieu being like this like utility Gold Glover given where he is in his career, but I mean that's just a part of getting older and injuries and so on. But I don't know, like, I mean, if they wanted to, I feel like they probably could make it. Like, there's a way to get Dalton Varsho Gold Glove this year because he deserves it. I really hope it happens because he absolutely deserves it. To Eddie's other point on Ernie Clement, he had the RBI single to take the lead bottom of the sixth inning. He's not presently an everyday player, Nick. But going back to the beginning of that road trip the Jays took before the All-Star break, 10 hits, 9 RBI, including 2 home runs. He's batting .286. He has an OPS of about .812. So all those numbers actually do not include today's outing, which was a successful one for him. So I'm assuming they'll look even better after today. But I do wonder, in your eyes, about Clement deserving to take a larger role, at least as long as IKF is out. Because when IKF is in, you can add IKF to the conversation of third base, who plays at third, who plays at short, who plays at second, really. He can kind of do it all himself. But if he's out and he doesn't seem that close to returning with the knee injury, they're going to be cautious with him. But if that's the case, I do wonder if Clement should take a larger role. And I don't know if we're like everyday player status quite yet, but he should probably play more often than not.
Clement is the type of player they should be giving looks to. He's not, strictly speaking, a prospect. He's bounced around a little bit, but he's taken a little bit of another step since joining the Blue Jays organization. Like, even in Buffalo, he showed a little bit more power than he ever had earlier in his career. We saw that on that road trip you mentioned. He's a very odd player offensively because he basically never walks. We saw that today. I believe it's 5 walks in 77 games for him at this point. It's really hard to be a good offensive player if you basically never walk. It puts a lot of pressure on you to hit the ball. He has done that, generally speaking. The thing with him is that he's significantly better against left-handed pitching than he is right-handed pitching. So the longer-term prognosis is probably more of a platoon guy, extra guy, utility man, someone who fills in when other guys are injured. It's hard to envision him as this everyday starter, but the Blue Jays don't have a lot to lose. So running him out there, a guy that you could stand to learn a little bit more about, does not hurt them. And, you know, this is part of, you know, an Aurelvis Martinez not being available, for instance. Like, you don't have a position to give to all of your prospects. Sometimes you got to try someone who's more of a journeyman, and Clement has given them good at-bats in recent weeks, that's for sure.
416-870-0590, 1-888-666-0590, star 590 on your cell. Let's go back to the phones. Let's go to Russ in New Jersey. Russ, are you actually in New Jersey, or are you elsewhere these days?
I'm in New Jersey. I'm not traveling for that team. Maybe next week against Baltimore.
All right.
So let me ask you a question like this. So first of all, I'm just curious. I didn't see. What was the crowd today? I'm just wondering, what was the attendance?
Actually, I don't know what the exact number is, but it was about 38,000.
Just over 38,000, yeah.
It's unbelievable. I don't know what people are coming for. I don't know. Maybe people don't know this, but Ty Cobb does not play on the Tigers these days to come for the opposing team. Or Cabrera's not as last year. People keep coming to the games. Shapiro's happy and the owner's happy. So I want to get to the Bo Bichette report, and
sure.
I've known this for forever. Not that I know Bo, but he doesn't want to play for this team. I think he's a guy. If you go back, you know, when they fired their last manager, you know, Bo was outspoken. He basically said, you know, we had to do this. You know, guys, you know, basically, I don't know, called certain players out, but didn't call it by name, but just said there was a little bit of a, you know, relaxed atmosphere and this and that. And I don't think he wants to be here, and I think that puts pressure on Toronto. But, you know, guys keep calling up about the 25 season. I don't know, you know, I don't think this team is going to be competitive in 25 either. So, you know, I'm happy when they lose these days. And I'm a Blue Jay fan since 77, since Doug Alt and Dave McKay and Roy Howell and Louis Gomez. But the bottom line is, I didn't want this guy Atkins to be 4 games out July 30th and telling me how he's still in the race, and because he knows his job is on the line if they don't make the playoffs. Most people expect him to get fired. So the more the Jays lose, the more it puts him in, like, you know what, you can't now I don't think we're going to get any great prospects for Danny Jansen or anybody. Maybe a little bit better for Kikuchi because he's a starting pitcher. But I would think of trading to Bassett if somebody's going to take him, because I just don't think 2025 this team has what it takes to be competitive unless they do something crazy in the offseason. And I haven't looked who's free agent, but that's about it. But I just, like, this season has just been so, so frustrating as a Blue Jay fan. And you know, I travel everywhere for this team, but it's just been so frustrating to watch. So, you know, they really need a change at the top and to start a little bit all over again. That doesn't mean getting rid of Guerrero, but I'd like to know what you think of the Bichette rumor.
Sure thing. Yeah, thanks, Russ, for the call. So in case people actually hadn't seen this, this was from earlier today. So Bob Nightingale from USA Today had the report. He writes a column every Sunday is how things go. So every Sunday it comes out on USA Today's website, and I think it has like a variety of things about a lot of baseball news and notes, sometimes international news, sometimes a lot of domestic stuff, certainly in America. But because we're close to the deadline, it's 9 days away, he has a lot of deadline news in there. So this is what he said about the Blue Jays. They are expected to trade pitcher Yusei Kikuchi, center fielder Kevin Kiermaier, catcher Danny Jansen, DH Justin Turner. They could entertain offers for Chris Bassett and Kevin Gausman. Are they willing to go all of the way and trade Guerrero Jr. and Bo Bichette? Too highly unlikely. And then a little bit later on in the article, he actually went on to talk about Bo and Vladdy. This is what Russ is referencing. Toronto Blue Jays shortstop, this is verbatim from the article. Toronto Blue Jays shortstop Bo Bichette has told friends that he would welcome a trade, while first baseman Vladimir Guerrero Jr. badly wants to stay in Toronto and is open to signing a long-term extension. So that's the report verbatim from Bob Nightingale in his USA Today column on their website. And the Vladdy stuff, not shocking, Nick, right? I think he's been pretty consistent over the years. And I mean, I wouldn't say he's walked it back by saying it's a business and, you know, who knows what's going to happen. I think that's just, like, the reality, right? I feel like his agent was probably like, stop saying you won't play for the Yankees. Stop crapping on other teams. Like, who knows what's going to happen? But, I mean, I feel like even if Vladdy does eventually test free agency, he might just, like, he seems like the kind of person, I'm just speculating, but that he'd bring that contract to the Blue Jays and say, hey, match this or beat it, and they probably would, honestly. So, I'm not a lot of shocker with Vladdy, but I do think, to Russ's point, it's basically the first time in, like, print, I'll say, print, quote-unquote print being what it is today, but first time we've seen written down that Bo would entertain a trade. I think, like, even you can say what you want about body language and his attitude, and now he's injured, he's on the IL with the calf strain and so on. You can say whatever you want about all those things, but I think that's the first time I've actually seen it that he would entertain playing for a team that's not the Toronto Blue Jays.
Yeah, we don't get a lot from him in a general sense. He doesn't put his thoughts out there that much. One piece of context I do think is important is that when he was in his draft year, he really wanted to come to the Blue Jays, in part because of their willingness to work with this kind of unorthodox style and let him be him. And so the idea that there's something wrong with his relationship with the organization, I don't think is based on very much. But I do understand that he might want to go to a team that's winning more ball games than the Blue Jays are winning right now. And he's also been with this organization for quite a while, and he has not yet received a massive extension that is one that he's willing to sign. So he could also feel some level of frustration with that, because often kind of star level players, which is what he has generally been other than this season, do end up with at least the big extension offer, even if they don't accept it, sort of by this point in their career. So there's definitely be reasons why he'd be interested in being on a different team. And I understand that this is a bit of a news thing, but at the same time, I don't think hearing this has changed anything radically, especially because the Blue Jays don't really have an avenue for trading Bo Bichette in the near future anyway, and with the injuries had this season, even trading him in the offseason might be difficult.
I'm not saying it's a slam dunk. You got to re-sign Bo. You got to keep him. You got to give him like the Xander Bogaerts contract or whatever. I'm not saying we're necessarily there, but I do think if you were to trade him now, you're effectively trading him at the basement of his value, right? Like, you're trading him at the lowest possible point. It's like the complete opposite, right? You don't sell low and buy high. You try to do the opposite. And I think it's for that reason I don't see Bo getting traded, like, certainly by the deadline this year. I just feel like it's too much work, I think, for all of that to be taken into consideration. If they really have not considered it before, there's no way they're going to just change their mind now that he's on the IL, because it's basically impossible to value that or gauge what other teams think of that. But I'm not saying it's not going to happen. I could see them trying to move on from him in the offseason. Like I said before, that I think my bold prediction for next year, Nick, was that Willy Adames would be the starting shortstop of this team. And so I think that obviously that would need to have Bo get traded. I'm not sure it's necessarily going to happen, but if it were to happen, like it would happen in the offseason.
I also understand the skepticism about whether this team can compete in 2025 with largely the players they have right in place. I get why fans don't feel like that's a likely outcome. At the same time, with the third wild card, we live in this era where mediocrity can kind of get you pretty close to where you need to go. And so I don't think that the team is ruling out the possibility of competing. And you know, whether it's a couple free agent moves, whether it's a couple trades, tweaking it, I don't think that this team is, you know, as bad, quote-unquote, as they've looked so far. I realize that there's only five teams in the majors that came in today with a worse record than the Toronto Blue Jays, and that's part of why this season's been so frustrating to fans. But the gap between this team and, you know, a team that is in the mix for a wild card maybe isn't as massive as it currently looks in the standings. And if you trade Bichette in the offseason, the chance of getting a similar caliber player back are very low, and your chances of then again trying to compete for this wild card, which is not super exciting because you want to be one of those teams winning divisions, but that's sort of where the Blue Jays are at. It really, you know, tanks that when you're getting rid of a guy who can be a well above average starting shortstop.
416-870-0590, 1-888-666-0590, *590 on your cell. Let's go back to the phones. Let's go to John in Cambridge. John, what's up?
Yeah, thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
Yesterday you were talking about Edwin Encarnacion not deserving to be on the level of excellent like Tatis is. And I'd like to disagree with you on that.
Sure. What's the case for Eddie?
Well, Jose had four 100 RBI seasons with Toronto. Edwin had four, plus a fifth season where he had 98 RBIs in 128 games. He has a higher career OPS. He's got 80 more career home runs and almost 300 more RBIs. He also has a higher OPS than in his career than Vladdy has just this year. And he has a higher OPS, a far much higher OPS, 878 as a Blue Jay, much higher than Vladdy. And you know, Vladdy is the same guy that you say is far and away the best player on the Jays, and you want to sign to 12 years. And also, when he got traded to the Yankees, Edwin, he was leading the American League in total RBIs, I think, either for six or eight seasons. Like, he was a consistent run
producer. What he did with the Yankees doesn't matter, right?
I'm just saying at the time. Yeah. At the time he was traded, the Yankees acquired a player that led the AL in RBIs total for 6 or 8 years. And my final point about Edwin is he didn't have a big mouth. Jose, if you remember, when they got eliminated by Cleveland, I think it was 2015 or 2016, where they got shut out by a no-name rookie pitcher. Jose, before the game, a day before the game, said that this pitcher should be shaking in his pants.
I do remember that.
And you remember that?
Yeah.
And I like to believe that maybe he wouldn't have pitched as well if Jose didn't open his big mouth and motivated this pitcher to skunk the Jays for that elimination game.
Hey,
I think Edwin is very deserving to be on the level of excellence.
All right, I appreciate the call, man. Thanks for joining us. I appreciate it. Yeah, I guess you weren't with me, Nick, yesterday, Nick. So someone had texted in about how people who should be honored by the Blue Jays, now that Jose is on the level of excellence, the next people who should be honored are actually Jerry Howarth. Is Jerry Howarth should be honored for obviously the many, many, many years he was the Blue Jays play-by-play and certainly radio color when he was with Tom Cheek. But Jerry should be on there. I said Buck Martinez should be on there, and I think those are slam dunk choices personally. But I think the other half of that was the other thing is I said yesterday, and you let me know what you feel about this in vis-a-vis the conversation we had here. But I had said that no remaining player who is not already on the level of excellence really moved me all that much to say like they should get on there ahead of like Buck and Jerry essentially, right? And so like I was trying to think of names who I in theory could be on there. I said Edwin, certainly wasn't sure about Eddie. And I say this with love because Edwin Encarnacion, I think even more than Jose for me, is my absolute favorite Blue Jay of that era personally. But even so, like Edwin Encarnacion, Vernon Wells probably has, I think in terms of counting stats, has a lot better counting stats than Edwin than in like basically every respect. And we never talk about Vernon Wells getting on the level of excellence. Jose was like the slam dunk candidate, right? Because he had just retired a couple of years ago. I think they were really, and he kind of like hung around without playing with the team, without formally retiring for a while. And then he finally did, and they put his name up there as he so deserved. But, you know, like, I guess there are other, like Jimmy Key, I suppose, could get up there in theory. But it just, all the names on there have done absolutely ludicrous things for this franchise and or have won a World Series, essentially. And I think that's why it's tough for me to gauge the guys like Wells and like Encarnacion, because I mean I was a big fan of them both. I'm not gonna pretend otherwise, but I just, if that, like, if you're drawing the line on the level of excellence for like at a certain place, I feel like you probably, I don't know, I personally draw it above the two of them. I don't know if you do.
It is a very difficult thing to gauge, right? It's such a subjective thing. What is the level of excellence? We you know, there's plenty of space. So, you know, people talk about sort of big hole, small hole for the Hall of Fame. You can be big level of excellence, small level of excellence. I think the difference between Bautista and Edwin Encarnacion is that for a couple of years there, Jose Bautista was one of the very best players in baseball in a way that Encarnacion never quite reached. Like, we're talking about him being top four in MVP voting multiple times, him leading the league in home runs multiple times, at a time when people weren't actually hitting that many home runs, especially compared to what happened later. And with Encarnacion, he never had an MVP finish above 11th, right? He was, like, very consistent. He was the middle-of-the-lineup guy you would draw up and want on your team. And season in, season out, he did it for them. He's also on the team for less time than Bautista. So I think there's, for me, there's not much debate as to who is more deserving, Bautista or Encarnacion. It's Bautista. But I think you could make an argument that, sure, put Encarnacion on there as well because he was such a fantastic hitter. He had that moment for them in the wild card game, like one of the big moments in Blue Jays playoff history, especially recent playoff history. So I get it. I don't know. I'm inclined to be inclusive. I'll say, sure, why not throw him up there? But you could definitely make a case either way. And again, if you're comparing him to Bautista, I think it is totally reasonable that they went with Bautista first.
Okay, if you're comparing him to Vernon Wells, then.
See, that's interesting.
Because Vernon Wells, I was just looking it up. Vernon Wells has, actually, Edwin Encarnacion has more home runs than Vernon Wells as a Blue Jay. I think it's like 8 or 10 more home runs, essentially. But Vernon Wells has essentially, and Vernon Wells also played a lot more for the Blue Jays, certainly, as well, in terms of just length of time. But he has, you know, hits, home runs, RBI, stolen bases, batting average, OPS, like they're all like incredible stats for Vernon Wells. And it's just, we like never, like, I just mean, if Edwin Encarnacion goes up there, then I think it at least opens the discussion. And I'm not saying he doesn't deserve to go up there. It's just that if we're talking about the next person to go up there, I feel like the next two people who should go up there beyond Vernon Wells and Edwin Encarnacion, as much as I love them, should be Jerry and Buck, essentially, for their contributions to the team. I think that's where we are in the history of this franchise. All the greatest players, essentially, now that Jose is up there, are effectively already up there.
Oh, there's no doubt the broadcasters should go there because they're such a crucial part of the experience the fans have. Like, you talk about fans who have followed this team since 1977. Like, that person is in your living room, is in your car with you. Like, there's an intimate relationship, and the Blue Jays have been extremely fortunate to have incredibly talented broadcasters over the years. So I don't think anyone is pushing back on that. Vernon Wells is interesting. Like, he's someone who is sort of, you know, he was a bit up and down. Like, he had some great years, he had some okay years, and I don't know how much you necessarily want to reward kind of that straight longevity. And I feel like the angle with him is more of a longevity angle. Like, he was a really good player, but not really sort of a league-wide superstar type. And then you might wind up with a player down the road who spends, I don't know, 13 years at the Blue Jays. It's like, do you throw them up there?
That kind might be Vladdy at some point.
Could be Vladdy. Knows, right? And, you know, and Vladdy might have a different case in the future as someone who's come close to the MVP and things like that. Vernon Wells is someone I probably would be hesitant to, but, you know, he was a really good player and he was here for a long time and he did have some notable seasons, that's for sure.
I just, like, wish there was, Like, you know, when they renovated the stadium, I said this a couple times, that I kind of wish they had like carved out a part of the ballpark somewhere where, and I mean, like, you're not going to do what the Yankees did when they built the new Yankee Stadium. Like, they have Monument Park and they have like a place where you can go, and there's like, you know, all sorts of ridiculous artifacts from like this long storied franchise. The Dodgers have something similar. The Red Sox have something similar. Like, it's like built into the various parks, like Yankee Stadium, Fenway, Chavez Ravine, etc. So, you know, the Blue Jays are like a relatively new franchise, like when you compare them to really old teams like the Yankees and so on. But I just kind of wish they had like some kind of area where they were an exhibit you could kind of like, even if it was a really small one, you could walk through in some sense, where you could see like the bat Edwin had when he hit the walk-off home run in the AL wildcard game. And you know what I mean? Like, stuff like that I think would be really cool, because they do deserve to be recognized. I'll say that. Like, it's not that they shouldn't be recognized. It's just that the team only has one avenue for doing it right now. It's the level of excellence, essentially.
Yeah, even though the Blue Jays don't have a history that you can throw up against the Yankees. That's just like an objective fact.
Yeah,
as much as everyone who's listening, I'm sure, hates the Yankees and doesn't want to hear that, I do think it would be cool if there was some kind of, you know, mini museum type thing in the ballpark. I think also a lot of Blue Jays fans came to this team through the 2015 and 2016 run. There's sort of a new generation of,
sure,
Blue Jays fans, and some of those guys, you know, I think about Roy Halladay, or Carlos Delgado, players are very central to my enjoyment of the Blue Jays growing up in Toronto. And I think a lot of this generation of fans could learn more about those players like Vernon Wells, who was a big part of a long year for the Blue Jays. Even that, you know, the massive playoff drought era, which is going to go down as a negative in the scheme of things for the Blue Jays. You can't deny that it sucks to miss the playoffs for over two decades, but there were some amazing players that came through here. And I do think that as there grows to be more and more new generations of Blue Jays fans, some recognition of the past beyond kind of names on this level of excellence that don't mean that much to certain fans who just didn't engage with those players.
I see a text here from David in Dartmouth. The sunny Sunday Springer special that inspired his team and fans for an exciting ball game, finishing by Springer's catch, making the final out for the win. Well done from the Blue Jays. Oh, this was an interesting one we got in earlier. We'll take a break after this, Nick. This was from Mark and Thorold, and I always enjoy Mark's text. Mark's good at entertaining one of my favorite things, which is fake trades and fake lineup constructions. I love that kind of stuff, Nick, I admit. So Mark says, hey, Show, I've heard you say before you would have consideration of signing Willy Adames for next year. I agree with that. I have another name for you I think the Jays should look at next year to play left field, Canadian Tyler O'Neill. I'm actually not sure what Tyler O'Neill's contract situation is, because obviously in the offseason he was acquired from the St. Louis Cardinals and is now just hitting just dingers all the time for the Boston Red Sox, which kind of burns me. I kind of wish he was, like, if he was doing it for literally any other team that's maybe not in the AL East, I feel like it would be more palatable. But and then he came here and did it when the Red Sox were at the Rogers Center and hit like three home runs in that three game set. But he says Jay should look at Tyler O'Neill. Next year you can build from Springer, Horwitz, Vladdy Jr., Adames, O'Neill, Bo at second base, potentially Aurelvis Martinez, IKF, Varsho, and a catcher. And I think that's, I mean, and I guess the catcher would probably be Kirk, right? Because Kirk is going to be on the team for the foreseeable future, you would think, barring some kind of massive shakeup. But it's an interesting thought process for Tyler O'Neill, Willy Adames. I can't imagine it's going to cost a ton to sign Tyler O'Neill. I think it will cost you a lot of money to sign Willy Adames, just because generally, by and large, shortstops get paid a lot of money.
O'Neill's not going to be cheap, though. Like, this is a player who is going to be entering his age 30 season, so he's relatively young for a free agent. He's having an incredible platform year with the Boston Red Sox. His career has been pretty inconsistent. He's had some very good power seasons and then some seasons that have been marred by injury, and he's been more of a kind of league average sort of hitter. When the Blue Jays look into this offseason, one of the corner outfield positions, presuming Springer will be in right and Varsho will finally be given the reins in center that he's probably should have,
yeah,
you know, years ago, arguably, when he first came over, that left field spot is a really interesting one, because there's probably a time earlier this year when Davis Schneider was rolling and you might have thought, oh, maybe that is the solution in the corner outfield. That doesn't seem to be something they can count on. He may well turn things around later in the season, but that's not a player right now that you kind of hand a spot to and forget it. So one of the positions that the Blue Jays are really going to be looking at, I think, in this offseason is that left field spot. And O'Neill is someone who gives them potentially that thump that the lineup has missed outside of Springer and outside of Vladdy in recent weeks. So I see a pretty natural fit there. I will say that often you see when there's a Canadian player, people are desperate to just put them on the Blue Jays because the Blue Jays are the only Canadian team. It's not always that simple. But I'm sure he would be embraced by the fans as a Canadian who can absolutely clobber the ball.
Before we take a break, let's get one more phone call in here. Let's go to Jay in Ithaca. Jay, what's up?
Oh, hey, guys. It was nice to revel in the exciting game and talk about George Springer, and that's a great thing. But for me right now, as a fan of the game, and I'll watch win or lose, I'll watch any baseball on TV. The season right now, it's beyond the evaluation of a singular game or a singular player's performance. It's more of a global view of this team and the franchise. And the discussions that are probably going on and should be going on are front office, executive, ownership-related decisions. Because right now, in my opinion, this team is not going to be competitive next year. And it's going to be even less competitive in the next 2 years after that. Or more. We are looking at, in my opinion, it's kind of like the eighth or ninth year of Shapiro's presidency. It's kind of like an 8 or a 9 year old car. Do I put in the money and try and fix it and get a few more years out of it? Or is it time to just sell the car and get something new? And in my opinion, the team at the major league and minor league levels is so flawed in so many areas that it's just time to honestly clean house from a managerial point of view, coaching point of view, executive point of view. And I'm ready to take the pain because I'm not really excited about maybe battling to be fourth place in the AL East for 3, 4, or 5 years with the Yankees and the Orioles going to be so strong and not have any postseason success. Let's just take the pain, do what the Orioles did a few years ago. I'm happy to live in the cellar. But I don't have confidence in the current regime to draft and develop. So anyway, it's a little bit of a negative take, unfortunately, although we love the game. That's where I see this going. And I don't think we should be talking about competitive baseball in Toronto, possibly, until the late 2020s, early 2030s at this point. I hope I'm wrong.
Hey, Jay, thanks for the call. I'll say this. I actually wholeheartedly disagree with Jay, not in the sense that you shouldn't get a new management. I do agree with that, actually. So maybe I shouldn't say wholeheartedly. But so a couple things there. It's when you have an ownership that has given you the payroll that you have now, which is, like, an absurd amount of money. It's like $230 million. If that money is being directed towards appropriate areas, then I'm not saying it's not hard work, but if you have different management, and I think that is where it starts for me personally. I do think it's we're not talking about like 2029 with for this team to be competitive. I think it is easier than you think to have a team come up if it will require trades and it will require free agent signings. And again, I think I agree with the caller Jay in that you can't have the current regime do that. But I mean, there's no way that you can do what the Orioles did. Like, no, I'll say this, Nick. No team can do what the Orioles did anymore. The way teams have now been essentially disincentivized from tanking because of Major League Baseball, and you get a top 10 pick 1 year, you can't get a top 10 pick the next year. Just the way it has changed, and the lead time on draft prospects being what it is in baseball versus like the NFL or the NBA. The NHL is a little similar, I suppose, right? Because, you know, most guys you draft in the NHL top 10 or whatever, probably not going to play for those franchises in that given year. Like Macklin Celebrini, probably going to play for the Sharks this year, right? The rest of the top, those guys, 2 through 10, probably most of them are not going to play for their teams this season, even if they go on to become very good NHLers. So I think that those two sports are kind of similar. I just don't really think teams can do what the Astros did in the 2010s, 2000s, 2010s. I don't think teams can do what the Orioles did in pretty recently. And I think the jury's still out on the Orioles. They have to actually win a World Series for that, I think, in my opinion, to be considered successful. The Astros did. So, I don't know. I'm not sure blowing it up and tearing it down to the studs is really ever going to happen, because Major League Baseball has essentially made it so that if you do that, you're not guaranteed to be good, essentially. And for every rebuild that exists, like the Astros and Orioles, there's like 8 others that also exist that still haven't gone anywhere. Look at the Tigers. Tigers were here today. Tigers have been rebuilding for ages. Like, the Royals only got a whole bunch of false starts on their rebuilds, and they only got started because they now have some guy named Bobby Witt Jr., essentially, right? Like, your rebuilds are not guaranteed, which is why I think it's not going to happen.
Yeah, bottoming out is no guarantee of success. And also getting those high draft picks in baseball, as you say, those players don't play for you right away. I think it's a little bit more volatile than some other sports.
And like now there's a lottery.
Yeah, like the NBA, for instance. Okay, you got Victor Wembanyama. Now your franchise is in a totally different place. The impact of one or two players in baseball is just not quite the same there. There are some good players remaining on the Toronto Blue Jays, even if it doesn't feel that way. And I do think that kind of building around those guys and, you know, supplementing with trades and free agents is going to be the way it's done. And then, yeah, maybe 2027, you are looking at sort of a 2026 relatively clean slate because a lot of guys are coming off the books. But as you say, Sho, if the investment continues to be there from ownership, there's going to be the ability to backfill those with competent players, whether that's through free agency or trade. So as long as the payroll commitment remains relatively high, there is a way to maneuver this thing around that's not necessarily going to take 5 years, 6 years. It's not guaranteed to succeed either. It could totally crash and burn. We sure could be in for a terrible year of Toronto Blue Jays baseball. That does not feel like as much of a foregone conclusion as some of the more pessimistic fans are feeling right now.
And I'm not saying you can go out there and easily compete with teams like the Yankees and Red Sox that often feel like they have like bottomless pits of money to send at anyone you want. But I mean, again, I think it's certainly a big if, in the sense that if ownership does continue to commit this kind of money to payroll, then you will be able to allocate resources more effectively if you had someone different at the wheel. But I mean, but certainly if they turn into like the Pirates or something and they decide, hey, we're not spending this amount of money on the team anymore, then yeah, like then Jay will be right. Like Jay, you will experience pain and have tough years and you know, triple digit loss seasons. But I just really think that's gonna happen. You know what I mean? Like they I think in my view, I feel like it's a generally accepted from all major sports that if your team is good, butts will be in seats, and therefore you will make more money, right? Like, I just feel like that's like the easiest way to make even more dollars, make it more bang for your buck on what you've already invested. I think that's probably why speculation on my part, but why you probably won't see some kind of drastic decrease in Jay's payroll next year. Doesn't mean they're going to be immediately competitive again in 2025, but I think there are enough blocks here that you can reasonably, with money spent more appropriately, because I've been pretty critical of like the Justin Turner signing or the Kevin Kiermaier signing or the IKF signing even, and hand up, he's been pretty good, right? But you know, if you'd allocated money a little bit better, maybe Teoscar Hernandez is still playing for the Blue Jays as a free agent, right? After signing with the Dodgers instead of re-signing with the Mariners, or allegedly he had a big time offer from the Red Sox, which, oh boy, imagine him playing with the Red Sox. That wouldn't look great for a lot of reasons. So I think there's better ways to allocate those resources. And I personally think that does start with a different GM. And I'm not trying to pick on Atkins, but it's just, you know, we've seen other franchises in many other sports can guys for with less regular season success over fewer years, essentially. So I think it's for that reason. I think that's where it has to start. But if it doesn't start there, then, you know, things has to have the potential to cascade a little bit.
I understand the pessimism. Like right now, we are looking at the 25th ranked team in baseball by record, and fans are hearing, and I'm not going to claim to be the greatest expert on the Blue Jays farm system, because I think a lot of people like to make claims and look at prospect lists, and there's so much that goes into that. But the industry perception is that this is not a great farm system either. So you're not looking forward to the present, and you're not looking forward to the future. That can put you in a dark space, but there are definitely teams that come out of those relatively dark spaces in, you know, a shorter 2-3 year turnaround. Like, it's not like, I think of a team like the Philadelphia Phillies, for instance, after they had won their World Series and they had their aging roster that they had signed forever, and they were just sitting in this decline phase, and they had no prospects because they traded them all away, and they were just stuck with these declining players, yeah, like the Ryan Howards and Jimmy Rollins of the world. And that's not where the Blue Jays are. Like, the Blue Jays are going to have flexibility because either these guys are going to come off the books relatively quickly, or they're going to re-sign them, and then that'll give the Blue Jays something to build around. They're either going to have flexibility or they're going to have building blocks. Again, I don't think they're one of the best position franchises in baseball, but they're not, you know, doomed to a horrible fate. Even that fate may befall them, but it's not a foregone conclusion.
I think that's where I fall too. Like, it's not like it can't happen, because in theory it could happen to every team in Major League Baseball, but I agree with you. I don't think it's something that's like written in the stars necessarily. Let's take a quick break. And when we come back, go back to the text line, back to the phones, and certainly a hair a little bit from John Schneider, Kevin Gausman, and George Springer as well. Those guys all speaking to the media a couple of minutes ago. You're listening to Jay's Talk. Still a couple minutes left here on the Sportsnet Radio Network.
I mean, there's a lot of games to play, I guess, you know, but at the same time, you know, I want us to go out and compete. And you know, to leave it all out there every day, you know, to not look at standings or to try to think too far ahead, just, you know, go out there and fight. And, you know, there's obviously times where, you know, guys might get down or, you know, us as a team. But, you know, over the next 2 months, I think, you know, that the guys here can lay the groundwork for what we expect for next year, for the future. You know, it's all about fight. And, you know, I don't want anybody to lay down in that room.
That is George Springer speaking to the media about maybe about half an hour ago, talking about what he wants to see from the team going down the stretch. I actually think that's the first time, Nick, I've heard George, or really any of the players, like really talk about like the future as in next year and not like the rest of the season, which I think I find really interesting. But I mean, the players know it, right? I mean, and Springer maybe in particular knows it, because he knows he's going to be on the team for at least two more seasons, more than likely, at the very least next year. So I thought that was interesting stuff from Springer, who speaks to the media after a 5-4 Blue Jays win to wrap up the series here at the Rogers Center.
Yeah, I think it's so easy for a player to say, we don't look at the standings, we're going to keep fighting, you never know, people have come from crazier distance behind, yada, yada, yada. And then you reach a certain point where if you start saying that, you just kind of sound silly, and it sounds like you're not in touch with reality. And I think maybe we've crossed that threshold now where the Blue Jays are so clearly out of it that to pretend that they're still in some kind of fight would just seem absurd. And so he's being relatively blunt. Like, we are laying the groundwork for next season. As you said, he's going to be on the team next season and presumably a season after that as well. And so they're, yeah, some, whether it's young players like Spencer Horwitz or Leo Jimenez, like,
sure,
player guy, yeah, whether it's the relievers, like all a bunch of relievers are sort of fighting for consideration for next year. Like, there's a lot of guys who over the next couple of months will have plenty of reason to be motivated to play as well as they possibly can, even if it doesn't necessarily translate into wins and losses. I think Springer reasonably wants to see his teammates fight, and I'm sure that's what they'll do.
That is Nick Ashbourne. I'm Sho Ali. You're listening to Jay's Talk here on the Sportsnet Radio Network. We're here for another 10 minutes or so. Still some time to shoot us a text, 590-590, name and location. You know, we haven't, you mentioned the relievers. We haven't talked about the pitching a lot today in this game. And I guess we kind of went pretty macro instead of micro when it comes to the discussion, Nick, of what went on here at the Rogers Center today. But I did want to talk a little bit about Kevin Gausman and maybe Guinness's Cabrera with you. So Gausman, 6 2/3, 5 hits, 4 runs, all of which were earned, 3 walks, 5 Ks, 97 pitches, 58 of them were strikes. And we were talking pregame on the pregame show about what to expect from Gausman. We were chatting about the splitter, the fastball, as we usually do. I thought it was interesting. The Tigers are a top 10 team in baseball in terms of offensive production against off-speed pitches. And he was pretty careful, I would say, for the most part with the splitter today. But he just ran into trouble in the top of the fifth inning. It was a four-seamer middle in to Justin Henry Molloy, a rookie, by the way, who just jacks that for a grand slam. He had walked 2 consecutive batters before Molloy hits the grand salami. It's just tough because he walked both of those guys with 2 outs. So you'd regularly expect Gausman, like of all people, right? Like you'd expect Gausman to be able to handle a single batter effectively with 2 outs, walks 2 guys, gives it the home run to Molloy. And he just lost command of the zone enough for it to bite the Jays. I did think it was that the Jays bats got him off the hook was obviously a positive, but that he also bounced back for innings, I guess, 6 2/7 because he finished with 6 2/3. I thought it was a nice job, not only from the Jays offense, but even just from himself to bounce back after he got kind of restaked to a lead in this game.
It's always difficult to evaluate an outing where one crucial play really makes a difference, right? Like, it, that Grand Slam, it's pretty hard to have a good outing when you go up a Grand Slam. Like, that's just the reality of it. And so you can't come away from this saying, oh, that was a great start by Kevin Gausman, because it wasn't. You know, he gave up too many runs for how many innings he pitched. Like, that's kind of the bottom line of it. The walks were also troubling. Like, this is his 20th start of the season. It's only the fourth time he's walked three or more guys. Like, when he's on his game, he's attacking the strike zone effectively. He didn't get a ton of strikeouts, as you mentioned. He only got seven swing and misses all day. It just felt like the velocity was there, but he was just a little bit off with command for basically the whole day. And it kind of feels appropriate that it would be him making a mistake with command that would cause this. But as you mentioned, he does deserve credit for being efficient with his pitches, getting deep into the game, and bouncing back from making that big mistake. And, you know, to use the classic cliche, like, he gave them a chance to win. Was his best outing? No, but he kept his team in the game, even if he did give up that lead. And it's not, it's not vintage Gausman by any stretch of the imagination, but it wasn't a disaster of an outing either.
Well, after Gausman, too, and again, I think you're right. I think it was not a right game, I think. But if he had not come back out after the Grand Slam and then they had to burn through the bullpen, even with the day off tomorrow, I'm not sure I would be as positive about it. But I think there was enough there that I liked, the efficiency on the pitches. He did give up some really hard, loud contact, like, especially early in the game, but he kind of got through it pretty efficiently. So I think on the whole, maybe kind of a wash of a start, all things considered. But after Gausman, you get 6 2/3 from him. Cabrera comes out, and you get two pitches from Cabrera to end the inning, and then they send him back out for the eighth to take on the Tigers' 2-3-4 batters, and A.J. Hinch sends out Andy Ibañez to prevent that left-on-left matchup. I thought Cabrera staying out there, both against, like, in that situation, even in a matchup that's not great for him, because Ibañez hits left-handed pitching pretty well, but I thought that they sent out Cabrera to face 2-3-4 in the opposing team's order says something about where Cabrera is in the, you know, I like to say this, the circle of trust when it comes to the bullpen. I mean, right now it feels like the circle of trust is only Chad Green and this is Cabrera. Like, I am willing to put Jimmy Garcia back in there. I just want to see him pitch a couple more times in, like, relatively higher leverage than he did the other day. But if he's as good as he was before, he's going to be right there in the middle of the circle of trust. He's like, you know, temporarily on the outside because of the injury. But Cabrera, he got hosed a bit on some calls, but generally speaking, I liked what I saw from him.
He's been quietly becoming more effective over the last few weeks. Like, he's given up one earned run since June 9th. You know, that's 15 innings. Not all of his outings are an inning. Some of them are less than that, as we saw today, as someone who's a left-hander and gets some of those, that little specialty work. But he's striking out a few more hitters. The command is, you know, honestly, I don't even think it's ever going to be good. It kind of is what it is, but the stuff is compelling from the left side. He was a crafty pickup by them when they got him, because they got him at a bit of a low ebb, but he's always been a guy with a live arm and some interesting pitches in his repertoire. And is he a star level reliever? Absolutely not. Like, I think he's kind of a middle reliever. He's probably someone you'd prefer to be your second lefty option, to be honest. But in terms of where this bullpen is, he is one of the more trustworthy guys, because there's Chad Green who's there. There's Garcia, as you mentioned, as long as he can prove these sort of back. And the other guy that had been there for most of the season was Trevor Richards.
Sure, yeah.
And he has kind of fallen off a cliff the last little bit, which has been unfortunate for the Blue Jays, because he was someone they might have seen as at least sort of a minor level trade chip, and that may not really come to fruition anymore. But Cabrera is putting together a quietly decent season for himself, even though it's not always pretty when the command gets out of hand about.
Yeah, he's pretty wild, right? Like, he's a pretty wild guy in terms of, like, sometimes the pitches, he loses command a little bit, but he has some, like, the pitches he does throw has some life. Like, they have some real life. They move around out there. He can throw some real gas, too. I mean, there was a 97 mile an hour fastball in there at one point. So I do think he is in the circle of trust for me. And yeah, I said this yesterday, but Trevor Richards, he's out of there. He's out of the circle of trust. I feel bad for saying it, because I have been a Trevor Richards defender by and large over the course of my time here. But yeah, it's tough to defend the guy after. He's had a pretty good year up until the beginning of the July. And in July, he has been literally one of the worst pitchers in baseball. Like, starter, reliever, whatever, he has been. It's like an ERA of near 10, essentially, over many appearances over the month of July. And that did not get any better after yesterday. And then, obviously, doesn't count the Grand Slam he gave up to Jake Rogers, because a lot of those runs get charged to Yusei, right? So I'm not putting Richards in the circle of trust. I want to read you a couple of texts before we go, Nick, here on the People's Text Line, 590-590, name and location. Cheryl in Toronto, I've been to 15 other ballparks. All have history sections, even Arizona, with only one World Series and a much newer team. I actually didn't know that. I've never been to Chase Field. So, I see, that's the thing. Like, Tom Young had the good idea, even if it was outside the ballpark, you could do this too, which would be pretty cool. I mean, there's like an old defunct railroad track thing, a circle track just on the other side. Maybe Rogers can buy the rec room, put the Hall of Fame thing there. That'd be kind of cool, right? I see a text from Jason in Southern Alberta. A statue out front of Rogers Center commemorating the walk-off home run that Edwin hit is more than suitable. That'd be kind of cool. You know, it would be kind of cool. And again, maybe they're not historical enough to do this when you compare them to the Leafs, because the Leafs have also been around for a bazillion years. But the Leafs have Legends Row, like outside Scotiabank Arena. If there was something like that here, that'd be kind of neat, I think. Like, you could have big-time moments. Like, you could have, like, a statue of, like, Roy Halladay and Carlos Delgado and Jose and Edwin, and you know what I mean? Like, you can have stuff like that, I think, and that can be added to over time, which would be kind of cool.
There was a time when this franchise's success was so wrapped up in those two World Series titles, and then they had that massive postseason drought, that it might have felt kind of odd to do something like that, because like, oh, we're really just like fixating on these two runs here.
Right, right.
But because they had that second act in, you know, 2015, 2016, I think that now there's enough balance that you could have guy and some memorable moments in the 80s as well, that you would be able to do it in a way that didn't feel like, oh, it's all the only things that have happened for this franchise were, you know, 20 plus years ago, or it's only this little group of the history that we're going to focus on, because again, they had that next act that brought in a new generation of fans. I think that you could spread it out enough to make the history aspect compelling.
Yeah, and you know, like you said earlier, you could use that maybe as an opportunity to teach some younger fans about like what Pat Henkin did and what Dave Steeb did and what like the Terminator Tom Henke did. Like, you could, because I mean, I'm sure there are fans who are younger who, like you said, became fans in 2015, 2016, who don't know a lot about those guys. So I think that would be pretty cool. Before we go, this one's from, actually, there's no name in this one, but it just says, we badly need a Vladdy and Teoscar reunion. Teoscar is the perfect backup for Vladdy at number four in the lineup. Teoscar has lined himself up for a pretty big payday, Nick. But I do think that would be a fun view for everyone here if he does return next year.
Well, as I mentioned, left field is potentially wide open in 2025, he's someone who would fit in nicely.
You always fit in great with me. It's fun to have you back, Nick. I'm glad to see you.
Thank you. I'll be back with you again next weekend.
There he goes. That's Nick Ashbourne. I'm Sho Ali. Appreciate you being with us on Blue Jays Baseball, brought to you by the local family-owned Crown Rust Control Centers in Allison and Bolton. Protect your vehicle from rust today. Find your local family-owned Crown at crown.com, Canada's number one rust protection. For Nick, for Ben Shulman, for Ben Nicholson-Smith, Tom Young, Andrew Adams, Nick Blackmore, I'm Sho Ali. That does it for us. We are out of here. Enjoy the off day, everyone. Blair and Barker are back as usual through Friday. As Nick said, he and I are back next weekend. Enjoy the rest of your Sunday. We'll talk to you later.